Hello and welcome to This Day in Esoteric Political History from Radiotopia. My name is Jody Avergan. This day, May 28, 1851, abolitionist and women's rights activist Sojourner Truth is in Akron, Ohio, where she delivers a speech at a women's convention speaking out against both slavery and sexism. An account of her speech and the famous phrase, "Ain't I a woman," would become iconic, even if they are not completely accurate. So let's talk about it. I'm joined, as always, by Nicole Hemmer of Columbia. Hello, Nikki.
Hey, Jody.
And back with us again is Akila Hughes of the podcast What a Day and the book, obviously, and lots more. Akila, thanks again for doing this.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So, Nikki, we should say right off the bat that there is a central question at the heart of all this about whether the most famous line from this speech was ever actually uttered.
Sure. Well, I think it's very likely that it was never said. It doesn't show up in the records back in 1851 when she delivered the speech. And the actual line, "Ain't I a woman," is this kind of Southern Black dialect that was used a lot by white people at the time to sort of signify that the person was Black. Mm. But Sojourner Truth grew up in New York speaking Dutch.
Oh.
Like, she's not speaking in this sort of like stereotypical dialect. Mm.
It's funny. It's sort of like an old-timey version of white people on Twitter who are pretending to be Black, but they're like missing the beat.
Yep.
I can't tell you how many times I'm like, this is a bot that has like the back of a Black person's head as an avatar.
Well, yeah, and I actually think this is really important because the speech gets rewritten in 1863 by a white woman, and she's using it to sort of gin up support for the abolition cause among other white people. And in a way, it makes Sojourner Truth's speech more believable to other white people if it's stereotypical. And so it has, like, it's written in this kind of dialect that you would find in, like, minstrelsy songs.
Yeah.
It's just not very true to the historical sources.
Oh, man. I just can't stop laughing because I'm like, white people are still doing this.
Well, absolutely. I mean, like, that's the thing.
Well, it's the, like, be authentic but not too authentic, right? And I think it gets to something that's still happening today. You know, we talked about this a little bit in our MLK episode where he was always walking that line between when am I talking to genteel Northerners, when am I talking in a religious context, when am I talking in a more activist context, and it shows that people just aren't allowed to just be themselves and make and state their case. They always have to play to an audience.
Right,
it's code switching. And in this case, like, it makes sense that you need to appeal to white people because in 1863, the people who have political power and economic power and social power in the United States are white people. Mm-hmm. I think it's just very revelatory that you need stereotypes to make that appeal. And her speech, the shined up version of her speech, has circulated in American classrooms for a long time. But I don't think that we give enough attention to the fact that she was a feminist, to the fact that she was deeply religious. I mean, this is a religious speech where mm-hmm. she is bringing her feminism in and her religious knowledge and being like, look, we've been blamed as women since creation mm-hmm. for having made the world fall into sin. Mm-hmm. So if we have all that power, maybe we should be able to use our power to turn the world back upside right.
Yeah.
And then she talks about the birth of Jesus, and she's like, that took Mary and it took God. Where was man? Mm-hmm. Nowhere. Yeah. Why don't you let us sort this out since you seem to be absent from all of the important events in the world? And so I think that that kind of finding a feminist message in what is not necessarily the most feminist text, the Bible, makes this like a really powerful and important speech in the 1850s.
One thing that you think about here is the way she would make religious appeals. Obviously, she's making racial appeals and gender appeals. I mean, you know, we have a word for this kind of intersectionality now. How much is there space then versus now to talk about those things as connected? And how much do you have to kind of like silo those different conversations?
Right. I mean, I think that we're still really working hard to hear people as full people. Even just in speech, people will often be like, Black people and women, or like women and people of color. And I'm like, hello, I occupy both spaces. And I think the problem is when a ruling class or a group of people who have had power forever have only ever seen themselves as one thing, because like white women don't see themselves as white women, they see themselves as women. So when you have that, I think that there is like a full cultural unlearning that has to take place, because we've learned to categorize people as one thing. And so when you are asked not to do that, you're like, okay, but I can't box you in. And it makes it harder for me to figure out what to care about. And also, I do consider things to be a hierarchy. And so I don't know necessarily if, you know, it is worse to be Black or to be a woman or to be both. But I will try to, you know, make my own hierarchy in my mind. And I think it causes a lot of problems today just because it is exclusionary. All of these issues affect you all the time. When you're a woman, your life is impacted by being a woman all the time. And when you are Black, your life is impacted by being Black all the time. And I certainly don't think, you know, in the 1800s, there was even a shred of, like, these people are people, much mm-hmm. less this kind of person could be a woman. We were living just in a time where it's like there is absolutely no empathy for what is, like, the biggest struggle in this country, which is, like, slaves. So I think that, yeah, there was no chance for that. And that's probably why, like, you know, white people were like, cool, let's just talk to each other about this. And I'll just make this into, like, a woman speaking so that you can be like, oh, yes, that's right. This person I consider to be subhuman is at least a woman. So I can find some sympathy for that, you know?
And you can see how those challenges unfold over the following decades, right? Here's Sojourner Truth, who is making this argument for her rights as a Black woman. And yet, as rights are recognized, Black women are constantly being left out. I mean, when we look at the end of slavery and then the extension of citizenship to Black people, oops, it only goes to Black men.
Yeah.
When it comes to women getting the right to vote in 1920, who actually gets the right to vote? Almost entirely just white women, because Black women in the South, where the majority of Black women in America were disenfranchised. Yeah. And so for Black women to have full rights in the United States, it doesn't come to the extent that it comes until 1965. And that's when you start to get these really amazing essays like Frances Beale's Double Jeopardy and this thinking about intersectionality that finally breaks through, because Black women take a seat at the table and begin to define what this experience of exclusion was like.
That's exactly right. And, like, at that same time, that's when you're getting all this great writing about womanism and, like, breaking free of what has been the suffrage movement that has never really been about Black women. It's been about, you know, white women getting their rights.
You know, this still echoes to right now. You know, in 2017, there was a march called the Anti-Woman March in Sacramento, and it was done in response to what was seen as an overwhelming whiteness in the Women's March in Washington, D.C., and that's certainly been a huge conversation about how intersectional that movement is.
Yeah.
So these things continue to echo today.
1,000%. I'm not the only Black woman that I know who did not partake. I went to Disney World with my niece, nephew, sister, and her husband. I was like, I don't need to march. It really took my mother saying, like, oh, we marched. For generations, we've marched. You don't actually have to go and march to tell people that you're a person. Like, guess what? We said it. They heard it. They didn't care. So, like,
right. The problem isn't that they haven't heard the message.
Right. And, like, you know, we don't need to make a lot more money for Amtrak to take the train down from New York. Like, there's no benefit to that. And, you know, I think we could safely say, like, has there been any major change in women's rights in this country, like, for the positive since that happened? Absolutely not. Like, Planned Parenthoods are being closed all across the country. Women's rights have been under attack. Birth control is not always free anymore. Like, so, you know, it was a very cute symbolic thing that involved hats, but that's about it.
Well, I wouldn't be surprised if we do an episode of this in the future, and we will get into this. But you don't think that there's a connection between the wave of women who ran for office in 2018 and that kind of movement in 2017?
I think that for sure the midterm election was more diverse than ever. I think that was more of a response to Donald Trump than it was to the Women's March. And I think that the Women's March is its own response to Donald Trump. But I guarantee you there are people who voted for Donald Trump who were also present at the Women's March. And so I tend to believe that it didn't take a show of solidarity from millions of people wearing pink for women of color to run for Congress. Like, I don't think AOC was waiting for that. I don't think that, you know, Rashida Tlaib or anybody else in the squad was sitting there just like, oh, finally, this, like, the bat signal for ladies has come. I think that we had just gone through 8 years of progress, and to see an immediate rebuttal to that it was sort of the backlash to the backlash, I suppose.
Yeah, they're both responses to the same trauma, but not necessarily like one begetting the other.
Yeah.
One last question about just kind of how we remember Sojourner Truth. A, I just want to point out, like, this speech is really remarkable. It was reportedly delivered extemporaneously. We've obviously talked about the line, "Ain't I a woman," or whether it was uttered or not. One line that just stopped me in my tracks, and it just shows you the power of good, simple language. But, you know, at one point she just says, plainly, she says, "I can't read, but I can hear." And I just want to, I don't know, you don't have to respond to this. I just want to flag, like, how brilliant of a line that is as oratory, and just to say, you know, it just stunned me. But also, there's this really interesting element with her. Nikki, I wonder, like, A, do we remember her as one of our country's great orators? And B, you hinted at it a little bit, but I think we tend to, if you were to poll people, if they remember her at all, I think we tend to think of her as a Southerner. She, as you said, grew up in New York, grew up speaking Dutch. So what is it that, like, how history remembers people, misremembers people, and how has that played out with her?
Yeah, I mean, people tend to remember stories that are really sort of sticky, and they're sticky when they either surprise us or if they sort of reinforce our current beliefs. Mm-hmm. And so presenting her as kind of the, you know, the enslaved woman in Harriet Beecher Stowe's Uncle Tom's Cabin, there's just like room for one kind of enslaved Black woman, and that's it.
That's for sure. You definitely touched on it, and I think it's spot on. I don't think that many people, and I think that, you know, I'm specifically speaking to maybe white people who aren't from the South, but also white people from the South, because that history, I mean, look, the textbooks we had in school were all about benevolent slavery and taking slaves to the fair. And I'm like, that didn't happen. Like, to sell them? to lynch them at
but
the fair?
But it's in a textbook.
Right. Like, it wasn't for cotton candy and, like, tickets from games. But there's a reluctance to learn about it. So, like, the one tidbit that they latched onto is like, oh, when I think of the 1800s and 1700s, Black people were slaves. And slavery happened in the South, and that's it. And so I think that there's a reluctance to learn that history, but also, like, there are people who just refuse to know the truth about it. They would rather just say, yeah, every Black person back then, regardless of their stature or who they were allowed to speak to, was in the South, and they said, "Ain't I a woman?" That's pretty much it.
All right, we're going to leave it there. Nicole Hemmer, thank you as always.
Thanks, Jody.
And Akilah Hughes, thank you for doing this, and thanks for joining us last episode as well. So What a Day comes out every single day from Crooked Media. People should listen to it. And where can folks find your book, and what else you got going on?
Yeah, so look up your local bookstores, because they're hurting. So please get, obviously, Stories from My Timeline there. I'm also working on a Comedy Central series. So if you go to their Instagram and scroll down to find a picture of me and a very cute Milana Weintraub, you will see them. The series is called Making Fun with Akilah and Milana. If you Google it, there's 3 great episodes. And hopefully we'll be making more. So, yeah, check it out.
All right. Thank you so much. This was great.
Awesome.
This Day in Esoteric Political History is a proud member of Radiotopia from PRX. You can find out lots more about the show, including how to suggest the topic, at thisdaypod.com. You can also follow our social feeds on Instagram and Twitter at thisdaypod. Our researcher and producer is Jacob Feldman. Next week, we will be back to tackle one of the worst election year decisions a president has ever made. My name is Jody Avigan. Thanks again for listening, and we'll see you soon.
Radiotopia.